Now, real people, real opinions, Nighttime Talk.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
Anyway, listen, something on a more serious note. We've often spoken on this show about miscarriage, and we've spoken to many women on the show about miscarriage, but sometimes we don't think about the men behind it as well, because there are men behind it, because there are husbands, there are boyfriends, there are fathers of women who go through that. And sadly, about one in five women will have a miscarriage throughout their reproductive lives, most commonly in the first trimester of pregnancy. It is a deeply traumatic experience for any woman, and something we as a society still probably don't speak about enough, and we don't talk about it. It's like a kind of stigma. And when it happens, you don't know what to say to a person. You know, suddenly a person's not pregnant anymore who told you they were pregnant, and you kind of don't know. You just don't say anything, do you? Because you don't want to bring it up. But from speaking to women, generally, they do want you to talk about it. They want you to ask them what happened and how are they feeling, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, what the experience is like for them, because it's easier for them when they can talk to people about it. But something we speak even less about, as I said, is men's experience of miscarriage. But joining me in the line to share the male perspective on this very sensitive issue is a Cork man and an international best-selling author, Andrew Fitzgerald, who now lives in San Diego. Andrew, good evening to you.
Hey, Niall, how are you? I'm not calling from a toilet in a bar like your story with your criminal. I'm calling from the walk-in wardrobe, unfortunately. The guys next door are doing some construction and the fellas are banging away like crazy all day long.
Yeah, well, that was a true story, by the way. I won't mention the criminal's name on the air, but he went to jail for a very long time. But he came on to our show after a crime had been committed, proclaiming his innocence because he was out on bail at the time or something. I can't remember the exact details, but it was his ex-girlfriend was on the show screaming that he'd been released and she didn't even know. I don't think he wanted her to know, to be honest with you. Anyway, Andrew, you know, this book that you have, it's called How Did I Get Here? So let's just start with that. How did you get there? You're a Cork man, but now you're in San Diego and a best-selling author. So how did you end up, you know, immigrating to the United States, or how did that come about?
Sure, yeah. So my wife, also from Cork, Kane, and I emigrated 12 years ago to San Diego. We now have a boy, Alfie. He's 4 and a half. Jane and I were very fortunate. We entered the green card lottery in 2012, and we turned up trumps in that and decided to make a move to emigrate.
Okay.
It was something we always wanted to do. We left Ireland. We had great jobs. We had a house. We had all the things that you think you need. But there was a part of us that wanted to travel and go on an adventure. And 12 years later, we're here. There's been some tough times. And during those 12 years, we had some setbacks. And I captured it all in a book called How Did I Get Here? With the main theme of being resilient in life, that we can overcome anything as human beings.
And when you say you enter the lottery, do they still, I know they used to do it all the time, do they still do that lottery for the green cards?
Sure, yeah. So every year, America gives out 50,000 visas. It's its way of increasing its diversity, if it isn't diverse enough.
Yeah.
And anyone can enter, Niall. And if you make it through to get picked, then you just got to go do the background checks, so on and so forth. Mm. But every year it is, I think the only thing that happens is if the computer randomly picks a certain nationality. Say, for example, the UK was knocked out for a couple of years because the computer had randomly picked too many people from the UK, we'll say.
Okay.
That's the only stipulation.
Oh, yeah, like is there a quota from each country every year? There probably is, yeah, a certain quota from each country.
I'm sure there's a little bit of science in it, but like when we first did the draw, we weren't picked, and then randomly enough, I was down in my father's house. He was having lunch one day, and we hadn't told them because, you know, we didn't want to worry parents, and he said, that was terrible news about the green card lottery. So random, Niall. And I said, Dad, what's that? Like, I don't listen to my father, like all kids, but that perked my interest. And the computer had picked numbers 1 to 50,000 in numeric order and nothing random about it. So there was a redraw. Fast forward 2 weeks, a redraw, and Jane and I get picked.
Oh,
but
wow.
There's some Irish luck. Luck does exist.
That must have been very exciting times for you. You're kind of starting a fresh new life somewhere else. It must have been a very exciting time. Or was there a lot of apprehension, or were you all gung-ho and ready for it?
Well, I remember when we didn't get picked, how we both felt. We felt terrible. And we were really disappointed. So that kind of showed how important it was to us. But we were excited. Then we got picked the second time. You get 6 months to get yourself in order to get to America. Otherwise, your visa would be rescinded after 6 months. No, it was a great adventure for us. And when we got there, you know, we got settled, we found somewhere to live, we found jobs straight away, but we hadn't prepared ourselves for being homesick. You know, we wanted everything the same, but just with better weather.
Yeah. You're going out, and there's no sign. Yeah, there's no sign of Patrick Street in the English Market anymore. So, yeah. So, I mean, that it is difficult. No matter how much we think we want to travel, we do get homesick, don't we?
Of course, you're used to what you grew up in. I think we were 34 and 35 when we left Ireland. So, like, you live, you know, nearly 80% of your life in Ireland now at this stage, and now as time has gone on, we're familiar with our surroundings, our environment. We've built up great friendships. But it is difficult, you know, you have to kind of talk to each other and you got to be brave too to push on. We were very organized structurally, but we weren't emotionally organized.
And from a cost of living point of view, did you find it difficult to get set up, in a property? And, you know, obviously you said you got a job, but I don't know how good the job was financially. So did you find it difficult to manage or was it okay?
Well, no, we got going pretty quickly, but the problem there is, straight away your credit rating. So we had a good credit rating with the Irish Credit Bureau, but it's not recognized here.
Oh, okay.
So America's a great country. You got to get into debt to get into credit. So when we walked into the bank and we lodged over our 17,000 euro, because that's what we brought with us 12 years ago, she said, you know, the bank manager said, I can get you a credit card for 500. Go spend that as quick as you can. Pay off the 500. We'll build your credit that way. So that's the thing. So we had to pay our rent up front the first month, the last month, and a month's deposit. So we nearly wiped out all our money
in
the first month. The jobs were great to get going, but San Diego is the most expensive city in America. It's just gone crazy in terms of...
And what's property prices? I'm just curious now. What are property prices like in San Diego? Is it similar to Ireland? Are you looking at for a small bog standard house like $400,000?
Well, no. So, like, I'll give you an example of where we're living. A 3-bed, 2.5 bath on about 1,700 square foot is $875,000.
Wow. Okay. And that's dollar. You know, well, dollars are more or less the same as euro now, to be honest with you. They're kind of on par now. I think it's only 1.6 or
pretty
something.
Pretty much, yeah. The equivalent 400,000 house in Ireland would be going for 650.
Wow. Okay. And do you like the lifestyle? Do you like living there? You know, I mean, are the people nice? I'm assuming the weather is good because at least you get four seasons. But are the people good? Is it a good place to live? What's the community like?
Yeah, I mean, we're very lucky that we're Irish, first of all, as a nation. We're recognized all over the world for having the crack. But, you know, people generally, you know, gravitate towards Irish. And as Irish people, we're personable. So we've built up tons of friendships. You know, we do think of Ireland a lot. I'm married to an Irish person, so therefore Ireland is still very much in our daily, weekly conversations. I have a buddy out here who's from Tyrone, and he's married to an American, so they don't talk about Ireland much, you know, so sometimes it's hard to live in two countries at once. The lifestyle is great. It's vibrant. It's outdoorsy because of the good weather. But, Niall, it doesn't matter where you are when you're working. You know, Monday to Friday, you're in your job, and it's fast pace over here. The salaries are great. I do have to say, you know, you are rewarded. Mm. People are promoted for their hard work and ethics. And, you know, the American ethic is still there. You can be anything you want to be if you apply yourself.
Well, there's much more scope for everything, really, isn't there? I mean, there's much more. Yeah. I mean,
it's 50 countries within a country, you know, the 50
of course.
States.
And have you thought about moving? Are you happy with San Diego? Because as you rightly said, you know, it's 50 countries within a country. So are you happy to stay in San Diego? Or are you thinking that maybe we might try something a little bit different? We might go, you know, head on down south, Florida or something like that. I've spent a lot of time in Florida. It's a beautiful state as well. Are you happy to stay in San Diego?
Yeah, I think that the next move for us longer term will be to work our way back to Ireland.
Mm.
I think as Jane and I, so I know we come on to talk about Alfie, our son. Like, I'm 46, he's 4, right? So he's going to be 18 when I'm 60. But I do know in later in life that I want to be in Ireland, that Jane wants to be in Ireland, so reminiscing with our buddies that we grew up with, as much as we love America. And we became citizens. So, like, after 5 years, you can become a citizen. So we went through all that process. But I just think longer term, you know, we're going to continue to save for the future. Kids are expensive. I don't know what the communion scene is going to be like, because that was your first conversation earlier.
Don't even talk about that conversation. That went in a direction I wasn't expecting, to be honest with you, with those two Egypts.
So, once Alfie finds his way to college or into a trade or whatever he wants to do, he doesn't necessarily go to college, you know, later in life, we continue to save our money here and we want to get back to Ireland and we want to...
Well, that's going to be a big expense, Andrew, of course, because, you know, when Alfie gets to the point where he's going to college, as we all know, America can be one of the most expensive places in the world to go through third level education. So that's going to be something that you're going to have to think about. We hear of people remortgaging their houses just to put their kids through 3 or 4 semesters, you know?
Yeah, I know it's crazy expensive, all right. But I mean, I'm sure he'd be welcomed in Ireland as an overseas student. So maybe I'll encourage him to study abroad. But there are the things that we think about. But on an emotional point of view, later in life, you know, I do look at life later in life and say, what do I want to do and where do I want to be? And it's definitely to be around the people we grew up with and just that familiarity. The three things we miss, or I miss, you know, the three F's are family, friends, and familiarity. No matter how long you live away from home, I believe everybody will find their way back because there's people out here 25, 30 years that I know, and they still talk about Ireland every day because, of course, it's what you grew up in.
I remember my own uncle, he worked for the Cunard Lines, which was the Queen Elizabeth, which used to go from the United Kingdom over to stop off in Ireland and head off to New York, and he was a chief purser. So he spent so much time in New York, he rented out an apartment and met his wife, who was from Fairview in Dublin. And they ended up being there all the time. That was their base in New York because they spent so much time back and forward all the time. And he always used to say he never got American citizenship. He was there 50 years and never got American citizenship. He was always an Irish citizen. So even when he came home for a funeral or for a wedding or whatever it was, he always had to go through immigration to go back to America again, even though he lived there. But he never, and his line was always, we're not staying, we're coming home. He said that for 50 years. And sadly, the two of them, both my aunt and my uncle, came home in a box, because they died over there. But the biggest problem he told me over there was that his son and daughter, Mary and Sean, because America's so vast and kids tend to move out of state, you know, they might meet somebody or marry somebody or go to college or whatever. And, you know, to us, you know, if they live in Dublin and go to college in Cork, that's the worst you're going to get. But there, you know, you could be living in San Diego and go to college, you know, in Florida or something like that, which is, you know, basically the same journey again from Ireland to San Diego. So that's going to be kind of difficult, isn't it, for American people?
Oh, it is. It's absolutely. But it's very common. You're spot on. Like, kids will live in a different part of the country and not necessarily live at home going to college. So it actually builds a lot more confidence and resilience from the kids. I mean, kids, teenagers, 20, 21-year-olds, I mean, they're so confident. From when I grew up in the early 90s as a teenager, I'm like, they'd leave me for dust. So it is good for them to move away early on and figure stuff out. Mm-hmm. And the environment you grow up in is very important. So here, like the key word, everything is awesome. We know it's not. But the more you hear it, the more you hear it, it's very infectious. It's an incredibly positive country. Mm-hmm. It's not as personable as Ireland because, again, it's big and spread out and everybody's from somewhere else.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's pros and cons no matter where you are in the world. You got to make the best of your own situations. You got to see the humor in things.
Yep.
And you got to keep going. And that's what Jane and I did when we ran into some difficulties over here on a very personal side of our life.
Okay, I was going to get to that there. So in the book, How Did I Get Here? By the way, congratulations on the book. I know it's an international best-selling book at this stage. But you also, you know, document the fact that you went through a very difficult time with not just one, but 4 miscarriages, which is something we don't talk about to men. I've done so many shows and we talk to women and we've had experts on and all that kind of stuff. But we tend not to talk about the men behind the miscarriages because it equally affects them too.
Yeah, so we were devastated after the first miscarriage. So we had 4 miscarriages within the space of 4 years, all in San Diego, basically on our own because we've no family here. And, you know, it's the best news. And the parents listening tonight or listening back will tell anyone, you know, it's the best news to find out you're pregnant because you start thinking ahead. You start, you know, wondering what he or she will be like. And then you start looking at other people in the park and how will I handle that tantrum over there? Or that, oh, that's a nice buggy. I might get that one. And then, you know, we miscarried the first time and that was devastating. I mean, it's very difficult to process that information when the doctor says, you know, the pregnancy has stopped.
You know, how many months pregnant was your wife at that stage, or your partner?
Yeah, so we never made it past 12 weeks.
Oh, okay.
In fact, our second miscarriage was the night before the 12-week scan. We were so close.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, how did we deal with it? Well, we didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about it to anyone. We kept it to ourselves, you know, because we were stoic.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say we were Irish and we don't talk about things, but, you know, we could have shared, we could have been more open. We didn't tell our friends or family and kind of threw ourselves into our working lives.
At that stage, you hadn't told any of your friends in the United States. You hadn't told any of them that you were pregnant at that stage. So they didn't know.
Get past the 12 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so like that 12 weeks thing and, you know, that maybe that Irish old, you know, wife's tale of you don't tell anyone until you get past the golden period and you're safe and all that. So we hadn't spoken to anybody at all. Yeah.
And so the first time was devastating, obviously, for both of you. And I've spoken to many women on the air who believe it's literally like a bereavement. It is actually a bereavement, of course. And that can be very difficult. And it's a testing time for a relationship, too, by the way. That can be very, particularly for you guys, because you're out in the middle of nowhere. You don't have the same support system you might have had here in Cork because you would have had family around you. So it's just the two of you, basically, dealing with it. So that was testing on the relationship, I imagine, as well, was it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we grieve in different ways, men and women and people. And, you know, you go through the different stages of grief. You know, there's not 1 to 5 or however many stages there are. But I think it all came to a head kind of after the second miscarriage, where we kind of both kind of broke down around the same time on a Friday night. But it was brilliant to let it all out. Like, and we were devastated and we're getting on a little bit older as well. And, you know, you feel like you've missed out or lost something. But we made a commitment to each other that we would stay positive, you know, continue to stay healthy and you know, try and relax in life and maybe perhaps, you know, be resilient that things will work out in the end. The second miscarriage was very tough. We had people, imagine this now, we had two people visiting from Ireland with us, and Jane was going through a natural miscarriage in the house. They were out and about. I was 90 minutes away at a sales meeting. And she was going through it on her own. And whatever reason, you know, we just didn't pick up the phone to say, hey, we need help there. So I got in the car and I drove as fast as I could, you know, as safely as I could. The carpool lane in America is only for two people or more. I called the cops, the good Irish guy, telling them, hey, here's my car, Reg. I'm going to use the carpool lane. Please let me go. This is very important. I got to get home. And they were like, sir, I would not do that. We will pull you. We don't care what the situation is, you know. So I get home and she's in pain and, like, pardon me, but she passed the fetus in the toilet.
Yeah.
And they're looking at the fetus in the toilet and it's just devastating, you know. And
I know. I can't imagine. Yeah.
And the doctor said, look, it's just Mother Nature. And that's even harder, you know.
Yeah.
If you told me to go through a brick wall and things would be better, I would do that too.
Yeah.
So we had to sit with this.
And how did you deal with that, with the friends still there and everything else that were staying over and all that kind of stuff? That must have been difficult for you to deal with that situation. Did you tell? You obviously didn't tell them.
No, I'm sure they probably suspected something because,
yeah.
I mean, Jane was in serious agony and
yeah.
It was all a bit mute for the next couple of days and they were leaving quite soon after that anyway. So, I don't know what, you know, maybe it was just our phase in life that we were private people, you know,
and
you know, the American culture has helped us to be more open, to speak up, to talk up about things and just be more authentic in one way. You know, everything isn't, you know, grand, as we say in Ireland. Look, get deeper. Like, how are you really doing? You know, tell me what's happening in your life. And you'd be surprised when you start talking openly to people. And it never amazes us. We all know this. Americans will tell you everything. And sometimes you're like, oh my God, would they ever stop? But it's their way of dealing with things too, you know, and it invites you in then to the conversation. So us men, we're great at going for a pint and talking about sport. Ladies are good over coffee or whatever they're doing, just chit-chatting. But men could be a little bit braver too, you know, and I got lots out of telling my buddies. And since I wrote the book, it gave people a little bit of permission. It gave them an invite to say, you know what, Fitzy, because people call me Fitzy. I went through something like that too. And it might be a miscarriage. It could be you lost your job during COVID and you're still processing it, or it could be a relationship issue.
Because us lads, we don't talk about stuff. Girls are better because they've got better social circles and they're okay talking about sensitive stuff to each other. But as you rightly said, you know, men, it's, you know, normally the only thing we're ever talking about is how good the beer is in the bar here and isn't that a good game that's on the TV. So that's generally what lads talk about because that's what men do, isn't it? But that's what we're told anyway. But it must have been difficult for you then get on to miscarriage number 3 because, of course, I mentioned at the start of the show that 1 in 5 women will have a miscarriage. It's more rare to have 2. Mm-hmm. It's even more rare to have 3. And it's extremely rare to have 4. At that point, you kind of say to yourself, maybe this is not for me. We should consider other options. But so when you got to the 4th miscarriage, was there a point where you said, this is just not going to happen. We need to look at other options. Was there a point that came to that?
Yeah. So when we get to number four, I mean, we're conceiving naturally. We've no problem with that. We just can't get past the 12 weeks. So we look at adoption, because that's a very viable option, and isn't it great to adopt a child? But we weren't citizens, so that path was blocked initially at that time. And then surrogacy is a whole different world, and there's a lot of legal stuff involved in that.
And it's expensive.
Minefield. And
yeah.
I mean, yeah. Of course, that's a factor too. And then, but I guess what happened then was there was a little bit of acceptance came in. You know, we maybe that stage of grief. Well, you know, perhaps we're not meant to be parents, and that's kind of weird to say. Because
that's kind of sad realization sometimes for people. You know, that you're not meant to be parents.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just not working for us, or it's not happening, and for whatever reason, then the dust settles a little bit, and still hold out hope, but it wasn't a big topic of conversation, whereas it was all consuming, both of us, at different times. So while we still felt the emotions, it kind of faded into the background. You know, we got busy with our lives, we got busy with work, we got busy with social life. And then we find out we're pregnant again.
And can I ask you, when you found out you were pregnant again, and this is on Alfie's pregnancy, of course, and when you found out you were pregnant again, was it a case of you kind of feel at that stage it's a given that you're going to have another miscarriage? In other words, it must be terrifying, particularly for your partner. It must have been terrifying knowing that, you know, when is it going to happen? Will it happen week 11? Will it happen week 12? Will it happen week 9?
Yeah.
I mean, is it almost, do you almost think to yourself, this is just going to happen again? Sure, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, look, we celebrated again that we were pregnant, but then it was much more muted, and it was like, there was nerves straight away, and the doctor and the nurses knew our situation. We'd been dealing with the same medical professionals. But Jane was going for scans every week. You know, so she was over 40, so she classed as a geriatric in America, you know, so we call it a geriatric pregnancy. And like me, I was fussing around too much, you know, don't do this, don't do that, like kid gloves. But every time in the first 12 weeks, like, we were shitting ourselves, pardon my language, you know.
Yeah, I mean, no, I understand, I can imagine.
Going and this is going to happen, and how are we going to deal with this? Because we know already what it feels like. And then when we got past the 12 weeks, like, it was just celebrations. I mean, I remember jumping for joy, Jane was crying. And then we kind of were able to relax a little bit, week 13, so on and so forth, you know, and then the great day came. Alfie was 2 days late, but he was overdue by 2 days.
He made a grand entrance. Okay, made a grand entrance.
He did, yeah. And he was born in August 2019, and, you know, he's my hero, he's Jane's hero. And as soon as he was born and I held him, I said, like, we're going to have so much fun together.
That must have been just don't get me wrong, it's a wonderful moment when a child is born and you see that child for the first time and they look in your eyes and all that kind of stuff, you know, the little dark eyes because they can barely see you. But they look in your eyes and you look in theirs. And that's a wonderful moment for a couple when their baby is born. But for you, after being what you'd been through, and of course the whole idea of, you know, emigrating, this new life, and having four miscarriages and that whole disappointment for all those years, that must have been such a joyous moment for you.
Well, I was. I mean, I was so proud of him. You're right, Safe. I was so proud of Jane, you know what I mean? As a man, like, it kind of feel to take the responsibility on the shoulders, but... And I drove at 40 miles an hour back from the hospital. I'm sure dads and mums will know that feeling. And, people are honking at me at 70 on the freeway here in America. And I don't care.
Yeah, I have a baby in the car.
I get these two home. And we've just, it's been great. And COVID was fantastic, you know, which is kind of a weird thing to say because he was only 9 months old at the time. And we were both working from home and stay at home. And we got to see his first steps and hear his first words, whereas before we would have been...
You'd have been at work. Yeah, he'd have been in childcare and you'd have been at work. Yeah.
And you know, he's a great guy and, of course, he tests their patients, but, like, you can... And one of your callers said, just recently, the best thing you can give a child is time.
Yeah.
You give them your presence, and a presence as in being present in the room, and that's the greatest gift ever. I'll be like, Dad, come on, play with me, and
that's all a child wants is your time and your love. I mean, they don't really need 2,500 euro communions. they just want your time and your love and your attention. That's all they really need, isn't it?
Yeah, and he knows. We kind of spoke to him because we were camping one weekend in Ireland. He made friends with the kids in the camp, and one of them said, "Why don't you have a brother?" You know, and that kind of broke my heart. It was all, like, and he came over and he asked, and I said, well, you know, probably had a brother at some stage. Maybe it was four brothers too. We don't know. We didn't find out sex with the child.
Yeah.
And he'll understand that in time. But like when I wrote the book, you know, I really wrote it to give it to Alfie. I wanted to know about my life, James' life, you know, growing up in Ireland. You know, he's born in America. He's an American citizen. He's an Irish citizen now by naturalization. And I have a copy of the book put away from him. It's sealed. It's signed personally for him. You know, I hope he goes on to live a great life. Mm. I think about things now, you know, later in life, I have to stay healthy for him too. You know, I got to be around for him, you know.
Yeah.
The book details, you know, when I was a teenager in Cork, I flatlined twice and I was brought back and lucky to be alive. You know, I had a congenital heart defect.
Oh, gosh.
It happened on the soccer pitch. It happened on the golf course, which is not a physically exerted.
No, you know, mind sport. You, but that's quite, Andrew, that's so much more common than you imagine. The amount of people that I've heard about who've died on golf courses of heart attacks. Now, I would have always imagined golf is not really a sport that, you know, kind of puts you to your limits, but seemingly, I don't know, seemingly it must.
Yeah.
You know?
So I've looked at life differently and I didn't want to have any regrets. So I wrote the book. It's done great. It's been out for 12 months. People can find it on Amazon. How did I get here? Traveling the road to resilience. But the big thing about the book is, like, it's not all about the, and by the way, I work in sales as my profession and sales are sales. The royalties from the book goes into Alfie's account and he can do the money.
Well, that's really good.
That money. But people have called me up and said, my book, and strangers.
Yeah.
And that's what the most fascinating thing about it is. Hey, I got a lot out of your book. I'm dealing with a situation from my past. At the end of each section, I share some ideas from my experience about how you can overcome things, continue to grow, chase your dreams. I mean, like, it's life is so, so short, and we all say that. But the reality is, when I see Alfie on the ground and what we've been through, like, it's very difficult for me to ever be cross with him. But, you know, he does test my patience. But for me personally, you know, when I woke up at 18 years of age in the Mercy Hospital intensive care after, you know, being flatlined and brought back, I asked the nurse one question, how did I get here? So I didn't know where I was, and that's the name of the book. And ever since then, I don't make reckless decisions, but I kind of make decisions based on when I'm 80, will I regret that I didn't chase that dream or I tried it? You know, even try and move towards something that you really want to do. So everyone listening, you should, you know, really chase after those things that you haven't done in life.
Yeah, I always say that to people, if you get an opportunity, you know, don't miss out on it because you will regret it. And there's always a risk in opportunities, by the way. I mean, there was a risk in you moving to San Diego. It could have all well flat in its face. But if you didn't do it, you'd regret it. You know?
Oh, I know. I mean, if we didn't take up that green card, we would be forever asking, I wonder.
Yeah.
That's probably the worst feeling. You know, I wonder what that would have been like.
Well, look, if people want to get the book, it's called How Did I Get Here? The Road to Resilience, and it details your whole story, which a lot of it you've given us to us tonight as well. It sounds really intriguing, and for people maybe who are thinking of moving to America, maybe give them some sort of insight into how difficult that change can be, or how easy that change can be as well, and how wonderful the change can be. I wish you well, Andrew, and you and your partner, you, Jane, and Alfie, and I hope you have a wonderful life, all three of you together in San Diego. And I hope you're around for a long, long time to see Andy, or Alfie, should I say, Andy, to see Alfie graduate from college, wherever it happens to be, and throw his hat in the air, et cetera, et cetera. They're all the moments I'm sure you're looking forward to in your future life. And I wish you all well, and I wish you well with the sale of the book. I know it's doing really well at the moment. And as I said, it's on Amazon. It's called How Did I Get Here? If you want to go and look it up, it's by Andrew Fitzgerald. Andrew, thank you very much indeed. And I appreciate you coming on the air, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Neil. You're very kind. Really appreciate it.
Now, real people, real opinions, Nighttime Talk.
Ireland's classic hits radio.